Disc 2.
How fit the men of EASY were was demonstrated at McCall when the Department of the Army had Strayer's 2nd Battalion, already famous for the march to Atlanta, take a standard physical fitness test. The battalion scored 97%. As this was the highest score ever recorded for a battalion in the Army, a Colonel Jablonski from Washington thought Strayer had rigged the score. Winters recalled, "They had us run it a second time. Officers, men, service personnel, cooks, everybody. And we scored 98%. Promotions were coming EASY's way. All three staff sergeants, James Deal, Salty Harris, and Mike Ranney, were original members of the company who had started out as privates. So too with the sergeants, Leo Boyle, Bill Guarnieri, Carwood Lipton, John Martin, Elmer Murray, Bob Rader, Bob Smith, Buck Taylor, and Murray Roberts. Carson made corporal. Lieutenant Matheson moved up to regimental staff, while Lieutenants Nixon, Hester, and George Lavinson moved on to the battalion staff. Through to the end of the war, every vacancy on the 2nd Battalion staff was filled with an officer from EASY. Companies D, F, and HQ did not send a single officer up to battalion. Winters commented, "This is why communications between battalion, regimental HQ, and Company E were always excellent. It is also why Company E always seemed to be called upon for key assignments." In early May, Winter's 1st Platoon got a new 2nd Lieutenant, Harry Welsh. He was a reluctant officer. In April 1942, he had volunteered for the paratroopers and been assigned to the 504th PIR of the 82nd Airborne. After jump school, he made sergeant three times. He kept getting busted back to private for fighting. But he was a tough little Irishman with obvious leadership potential. His company commander noticed and recommended Welsh for OCS. Welsh was assigned to EASY Company, 2nd Battalion, 506th PIR. He had wanted to return to the 504th, but Army doctrine was to send OCS graduates to new units because it feared that if they went back to their old outfit, they would be too familiar with their enlisted friends. Sobel put Welsh in Winter's platoon. They immediately became the closest of friends. The relationship was based on mutual respect, brought about by an identical view of leadership. "Officers go first," as Welsh put it. At the end of May, the men of EASY packed up their barracks bags and joined the other companies of the 506th for a stop-and-go train ride to Sturgis, Kentucky. At the depot, Red Cross girls had coffee and donuts for them, the last bit of comfort they would know for a month. They marched out into the countryside and pitched pup tents, dug straddle trenches for latrines, and ate the Army's favorite meal for troops in the field, creamed chip beef on toast, universally known as SOS, or shit on a shingle. This was not combat, but it was as close as the Army could make it. The maneuvers held in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Indiana from June 5th to July 15th, 1943, combined paratroopers and glider-borne troops in the largest airborne exercise to date. On June 10th, the 506th PIR officially joined the 101st Airborne Division, thus making that date the greatest day the 101st ever had. Adding the 506th noticeably raised the morale of the 101st, at least according to the men of E Company. The maneuvers, pitting the Red Army against the Blue Army, ranged over a wide area of backwoods, hills, and mountains. EASY made three jumps. Christensen remembered one of them vividly. It was hot, stifling inside the C-47, and the heated air rising in currents from the hills caused the plane to bob and weave. Corporal Denver Bull Randleman, at the back of the stick and thus farthest from the open door, began vomiting into his helmet. The man in front of him took one look and lost his lunch. The process worked right up the line. Not everyone managed to vomit into his helmet. The floor was awash in vomit. The plane stank. Christensen, at the front, was hanging on, but barely. My stomach was on the verge of rebellion. Why don't they turn on the green light? There it is. From behind, shouts of, "Go, go, God damn it, go!" Out I went into the clean, fresh air. I felt as if someone had passed a magic wand over my head and said, "Christensen, you feel great." And I did. The maneuvers featured extended night marches, wading through streams, climbing the far bank, making 3 feet only to slide back 2, stumbling over rocks, stumps, and roots, cutting a swath through matted underbrush, and occasionally enjoying fried chicken prepared by Tennessee Hill people. The men were tired, filthy, itching all over. In late July, the maneuvers completed, the 2nd Battalion of the 506th received a commendation from Major General William C. Lee, commander of the 101st, for splendid aggressive action, sound tactical doctrine, and obviously well-trained individuals. General Lee expressed his confidence that future tests will reveal further indications of excellent training and leadership. Easy moved from Sturgis to Camp Breckinridge, Kentucky, where there were barracks, hot showers, and other luxuries. But the camp was overflowing, and once again it was the little pup tents for sleeping quarters, the ground for a mattress. It did not last long, as most of the men got 10-day furloughs, and shortly after they reported back, the entire division took trains to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. It was immediately obvious that Bragg was a staging area as the division prepared to ship overseas. The food was better, there were beds in barracks with hot showers and other improvements, but the real giveaway was a total re-outfitting. The men got new clothes, new weapons, new gear. They spent their days on the firing range, sighting in the rifles and machine guns. Where they were going, east or west, the European, Mediterranean, or Pacific theater, no one knew. Rumors flew from platoon to platoon. Bets were made. On weekends, the men went into Fayetteville to prime the pump at the town pump, one of the local bars. Brawls were frequent. Most were started by the paratroopers, who would pitch into the regular soldiers stationed at Bragg. They also goaded the glider troops, who were part of the 101st. The glider troops were regular soldiers assigned to the glider regiment. Although they were airborne, they were not volunteers and were treated by the Army as second-class men. They did not receive the $50 per month bonus. They had no special badges. They did not wear boots and blouse trousers. Some of them made up posters showing photographs of crashed and burned gliders with a caption that read, "Join the glider troops. No flight pay, no jump pay, but never a dull moment." A few members of Easy went down to the airfield at Bragg to take a ride on a glider. The experience of landing in one of those plywood crates convinced them that jumping with a chute was a better way to land. When General Lee made a glider flight, the landing fractured several of his ribs. "Next time I'll take a parachute," he remarked. "We told you so," the glider troops shouted. In July 1944, the glider men finally got the hazardous duty bonus of $50 per month and a special insignia. In mid-August, the division assembled in regimental formation. A band played "Over There," and the Red Cross girls cried as the men marched to the 20 trains waiting to take them off to war. Once aboard and somewhat settled down, the betting began over which way the trains would head: north toward New York, and then Europe or the Mediterranean, or west toward California and then the Pacific. The trains headed north toward Camp Shanks, 30 miles up the Hudson River from New York City. Promises were made about passes into the city, promises that were not kept. Instead, it was more inspections followed by inoculations. Shot followed shot, Christensen remembered, until our arms hung from our bodies like limp ropes. Officers and non-coms got to know the Preparation for Overseas Movement manual by heart. Sobel wrote up a form letter to send to the mothers of his troopers. "Dear Madam," it began, Soon your son, Private First Class Paul C. Rogers, each name was typed in, will drop from the sky to engage and defeat the enemy. He will have the best of weapons and equipment and have had months of hard and strenuous training to prepare him for success on the battlefield. Your frequent letters of love and encouragement will arm him with a fighting heart. With that, he cannot fail, but will win glory for himself, make you proud of him, and his country ever grateful for his service in its hour of need. He signed each letter with a flourish, Herbert M. Sobel, Captain Commanding. The enlisted men got hold of some whiskey. They were accustomed to beer, so the whiskey hit them hard. Christensen got so drunk he was making out with the toilet, a condition common to young men who have just been introduced to whiskey. Corporal Randleman found him and gently carried him to bed. The next morning, the air filled with the moans and groans of the hungover men, the company marched down to the docks. A ferry carried the men to a pier, where hot coffee and donuts from the Red Cross girls helped revive the near-dead. There was a great deal of cursing, partly because the men had hoped to march through New York City on their way to war and did not, also because they were not allowed to wear their jump boots. The reason? Enemy spies might see them and would know that an airborne division was shipping out. They had to take the patch of the 101st, the Screaming Eagle, off their shoulders. Winters remembered only one case of gangplank fever. A medical officer was just smart enough to know what to take to be assigned to sick call and miss the voyage. All the others lined up in single file to walk up the gangplank, lugging their barracks bags and weapons. As they stepped onto the liner, converted into a troop transport, and called out their names, a checker marked them present. It took almost a full day to get the 5,000 men aboard a transport built to carry 1,000 passengers. Finally, tugs towed the ship from her berth, and she started steaming out to sea. The men of Easy Company lined the rails to see the Statue of Liberty slip astern. For nearly every one of them, it was his first trip outside the United States. A certain homesickness set in, coupled with a realization, as the regimental scrapbook Currahy put it, of how wonderful the last year had been. Chapter 3. Duties of the Latrine Orderly. Oldbourne, September 1943 through March 1944. The Samaria was an old India mail liner and passenger ship converted to a troop transport. Originally built for 1,000 passengers, she carried 5,000 men from the 506th. The overcrowding created really dreadful conditions. Fresh water was severely rationed. The men could drink only at stipulated 15-minute intervals for a grand total of an hour and a half a day. The showers ran salt water, cold. The men had to wear their life jackets at all times and their cartridge belts with canteens attached, which meant that they were constantly bumping into one another. They slept in their clothes. One bunk was assigned to two men, which meant they alternated, sleeping every other night on the deck or in a hallway or wherever space to lie down could be found. The stench was simply awful. There were two meals a day. Christensen described his first breakfast. I didn't think we would ever stop going downstairs to the mess hall on the lowest deck. Stairs that were slippery with grease, and when we finally reached the bottom, the stench was almost overpowering. They fed us from large pots containing boiled fish and tomatoes. The cooks wore stained white clothing, stains on stains, showing they hadn't changed for days. The men ate the slop because they were hungry. To Webster, the mess hall had the air of a floating madhouse. At least the meals were a break from the routine, which consisted of walking the decks, leaning on the rail, watching the convoy, or gambling. The gambling was continuous. Poker, blackjack, and craps. Large amounts of money changed hands. Carson won $125 one night, lost it all the next day. Men tried to read, but they had precious few books. Captain Sobel tried to lead the men in calisthenics, but the space was insufficient, and it became another Sobel joke. On September 15th, the Samaria docked in Liverpool. The next day, a train took the men south. Trucks picked them up at the station at Ogbourne St. George and carried them on to their new home. They marched the last mile and a half, after dark, with only flashlights to show the way. The wartime blackout impressed upon the men that they were in a combat zone. They got to their barracks, which were Nissen huts, heated by twin pot-bellied stoves, were given mattress covers and shown the straw they could stuff into them, along with heavy wool blankets that itched, and went to bed. Webster wrote that when he woke the next morning, "I thought I'd passed out on a Hollywood movie set. All around the area were fairy book cottages with thatched roofs and rose vines on their sides, vast horses shaking long manes stomped down the narrow winding cobblestone lanes. A soft village green set off a weathered old gray 11th century Norman church whose clock chimed the hours just like Big Ben, and five ancient public houses, their signboards swinging in the breeze, bade us welcome to the land of mild and bitter beer." They were in Aldbourne, in Wiltshire, near Hungerford, not far from Swindon, 80 miles due west of London. It would be home for Company E for almost 9 months, by far the longest period it stayed in one place. Aldbourne was vastly different from Tocoa, Benning, or Bragg. There the men of Easy had been in self-contained, isolated posts, completely military. In Aldbourne, they were in the midst of a small English village where the people were conservative, set in their ways, apprehensive about all these young Yanks in their midst. The danger of friction was great, but the army put together an excellent orientation program that worked well. Beginning that first morning and continuing most of the week, the men were briefed in detail on English customs, manners, habits. Well-disciplined as they were, the men quickly caught on to the basic idea that they should save their hell-raising for Swindon, Birmingham, or London. In Aldbourne, they were to drink their beer quietly in the pubs in the British manner. They also learned to eat what the British were eating: powdered milk, powdered eggs, dehydrated apricots, dehydrated potatoes, horse meat, Brussels sprouts, turnips, and cabbage. The PX goods were rationed, 7 packs of cigarettes per week, plus 3 candy bars, 1 pack of gum, 1 cake of soap, 1 box of matches, 1 package of razor blades. Sobel didn't change. At the end of the first week, the men got passes to go to Swindon for a Saturday night dance. Sobel put out a regulation: no man would take his blouse off while dancing. Private Tom Burgess, a farm boy from central Illinois, got to sweating while dancing in a wool shirt with a wool blouse over it, so he took off the blouse. Monday morning, Sobel called Burgess into his office. "Burgess, I understand you were in town Saturday night with your blouse off at a dance." "That's right, Captain Sobel," Burgess replied. "But I checked Army regulations, and it's very plainly written that you can take your blouse off if you've got a wool shirt on and you are moving about or dancing or whatever." Sobel looked him up and down. "I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Burgess. You're going to wear your blouse over your fatigues all week. You're going to sleep with it on every night." Burgess wore his blouse during the day, but he figured Sobel would not be checking on him at night, so he hung it on the edge of the bed. The following Saturday, he went to Sobel's office to get a pass to go to the dance. Sobel looked him over. "Burgess," he said, "that blouse don't look to me like you slept in it all night. No pass." They were in England to prepare for the invasion of Europe, not to dance, and the training schedule was intense. Malarkey thought he was back in Tocoa. 6 days a week, 8 to 10 hours a day, they were in the field. They made 15, 18, 21, and 25-mile hikes went on night operations, spent an hour daily in close combat exercises, did some street fighting, and got training in map reading, first aid, chemical warfare, and the use and characteristics of German weapons. They made a 25-mile hike with full field equipment in 24 hours. Then a few days later, a 25-mile hike with combat pack in 12 hours. There were specialized courses on booby traps, removal of mines, communications, and the like. Once a week or so, they went out on a 2 or 3 day exercise. The problems were designed not only to give them a working knowledge of the mechanics of combat, but to teach the most basic thing an infantryman has to know: how to love the ground, how to use it to advantage, how the terrain dictates tactics. Above all, how to live on it and in it for days at a time without impairment of physical efficiency. Their officers stressed the importance of such things, that it would make the difference between life and death, that the men must do it instinctively right the first time, as there would not be a second. So the men of Easy got to know the English countryside. They attacked towns, hills, and woods. They dug countless foxholes and slept in them, learning how to do it despite rain and cold and hunger. In early December, back in the field again, the company dug in around a high, barren, windswept hill. The platoon leaders told them to dig their foxholes deep, difficult in the rocky soil. Soon, an armored combat team of Sherman tanks attacked. "They roared up the hill at us like primeval monsters," Webster wrote in his diary. "Stopped, turned, and passed broadside. One charged at me. My hole wasn't deep enough for a single tread to pass safely over me, so I yelled frantically, 'Straddle me, straddle me,' which he did." Carson's entry read, "It was the first time a tank ran over me in a foxhole. Scary." There was a lot of night work, Gordon recalled. "We would cut across country and crawl over fences and through gaps and go through woods and wade creeks." In the process, the members of the squads and platoons, already familiar with each other, grew intimate. "I could see a silhouette at night," Gordon said, "and tell you who it was. I could tell you by the way he wore his hat, how the helmet sat on his head, how he slung his rifle." Most of what they learned in the training proved to be valuable in combat, but it was that intimacy, that total trust, that comradeship that developed on those long, cold, wet English nights that proved to be invaluable. They were jumping on a regular basis, in full gear, learning how to use their risers to guide themselves to open, plowed fields rather than come down on a hedgerow, road, telephone pole, stone wall, or woods. In the C-47s, in the cold, damp English air, their feet were numb by the time the green light went on, so that when they hit the ground, the feet stung and burned from the shock. A major purpose of the jumps was to learn to assemble quickly after landing. Not so easy to do for 2nd Platoon of Easy on the first jump, as the platoon came down 25 miles from the drop zone. There was tension. Members of the 82nd Airborne, stationed nearby, would tell the troopers from the 101st what combat in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy had been like. The officers especially felt the pressure of combat coming on, none more so than Sobel. "It showed up in his disposition," Winters said. "He was becoming more sour and sadistic. It was reaching the point that it was unbearable." Sergeant Earl Hale recalled that there was a lottery going on about whoever gets Sobel. Sobel had picked up an Air Force sheepskin jacket, of which he was proud and which he wore in the field, making him highly conspicuous. Tipper remembered that when the company was going through a combat range with live ammunition fired at pop-up targets, Sobel experienced some near misses. More than one shot was aimed from the rear and side to crack by close to Sobel's head. He'd flop down, kind of bounce around and shout something, and jump up again. There was much laughing and gesturing from the men. "I can't believe that Sobel thought what was happening was accidental, but maybe he did. Anyway, he kept jumping up and down and running around as if everything were normal. The men continued to play tricks on Sobel. Private George Lutz could imitate voices. One night, E Company was leading the battalion on a cross-country march. The barbed wire fences kept slowing the progress. Sobel was in front. "Captain Sobel," a voice called out. "What's the holdup?"
"The barbed wire," Sobel replied, thinking he was addressing Major Oliver Horton, the battalion executive officer.
"Cut those fences," Lutz called out, continuing to imitate Horton's voice.
"Yes, sir,"
Sobel replied, and he ordered wire cutters to the front. The next morning, a contingent of Wiltshire farmers confronted Colonel Strayer. They complained mightily about the cut fences. Their cows were wandering all over the landscape. Strayer called in Sobel.
"Why did you cut those fences?"
"I was ordered to cut them, sir."
"By whom?"
"Major Horton."
"Can't be. Horton's on leave in London."
Sobel caught hell, but he was never able to learn who had fooled him and was therefore unable to retaliate. It was his jumping around, his hi-ho silver nonsense, his bull-in-the-china-shop approach to tactical problems that bothered the officers, NCOs, and enlisted men of the company more than his chicken shit. Dissatisfaction grew daily, especially with the NCOs. Sergeant Myron Mike Ranney, a 21-year-old from North Dakota, of 1st Platoon, and Salty Harris of 3rd Platoon, led the mumble-mumble of the potential disaster of Sobel leading the company into combat. The NCOs were fully aware that they were confronted by a delicate and extremely dangerous situation. To act would open them to charges of insubordination or mutiny in time of war. To fail to act could get the whole company killed. Ranney, Harris, and the other NCOs hoped that the platoon leaders would bring the problem to Colonel Sink, or that Sink would become aware of the situation on his own, and that Sink would then quietly remove Sobel. But that seemed naive. How could young officers, whose responsibility was to back up their CO, go to the colonel to complain about the CO? And what would they complain about? Company E continued to lead the way in the regiment, in the field, in barracks, in athletic contests. How could the NCOs expect Colonel Sink to do other than support his company commander in the face of dissension and pressure from a group of sergeants and corporals? These guys were getting ready to go into combat against the most feared army in the world, not to play a game or have a debate. So the mumble-mumble continued, and Sobel and First Sergeant Evans remained isolated but still very much in command. Weekend passes and the excellent British rail service gave the men a break from the tension. England in the late fall and early winter of 1943 was a wonderland for the boys from the States. Most of the British boys their age were off in Italy or in training camps far from their homes. So there were lonely, bored, unattached young women everywhere. The American soldiers were well paid, much better than the British, and the paratroopers had that extra $50 per month. Beer was cheap and plentiful. Once out of Altborn, all restraints were removed. They were getting ready to kill or be killed. They were, for the most part, 20 or 21 years old. Webster described the result in an October 23rd diary entry. "Although I do not enjoy the Army, most of the men in this outfit find it a vacation. Boys who had been working steadily at home enter the Army and are relieved of all responsibilities. It is unanimously agreed that they never pitched such glorious drunks back home." The excitement of the time, the kaleidoscope of impressions that were continually thrust upon them, the desperate need to escape the rigors of training, the thought of upcoming combat and Sobel's chicken shit combined to make this an unforgettable time and impel most of the men to make the most of it. "London, to me, was a magic carpet," Carson wrote. "Walk down any of its streets, and every uniform of the free world was to be seen. Their youth and vigor vibrated in every park and pub. To Piccadilly, Hyde Park, Leicester Square, Trafalgar Square, Victoria, they came. The uniforms of the Canadians, South Africans, Australians, New Zealanders, the Free French, Polish, Belgium, Holland,
and of course the English and Americans were everywhere. Those days were not lost on me, because even at 20 years of age, I knew I was seeing and being a part of something that was never to be again. Wartime London was its own world. There was an excess of drinking, whoring, fighting. Older British observers complained, "The trouble with you Yanks is that you're overpaid, oversexed, and overhere." To which the Yanks would reply, "The trouble with you Limeys is that you are underpaid, undersexed, and under Eisenhower." E Company was adding officers with the aim of having two lieutenants per platoon, in expectation of casualties when combat began. One newcomer was 2nd Lieutenant Lynn Buck Compton. Born on the last day of 1921 in Los Angeles, he was an All-American catcher on the UCLA baseball team and played football for UCLA in the January 1, 1943 Rose Bowl game. Upon graduation from OCS, he went to Fort Benning. After completing jump school, he joined E Company in Altborn in December. "I remember feeling rather envious of those who had been at Tocoa," he wrote years later, "and felt sort of out of it as a new member of the company." Compton quickly learned that Lieutenant Nixon, now Battalion S2, resented jocks. Nixon put Compton in charge of physical training for the battalion, which in practice meant Compton had to lead the battalion on long runs, the only officer who had to do so. Whether as a result of this experience or because of his athletic background or because he liked to gamble, Compton was close to the NCOs and some of the enlisted men. Too close, some of the other officers felt. He got caught playing craps with some of the men and drew a reprimand from the XO, Lieutenant Winters. At 1100 hours on October 30th, Lieutenant Colonel Strayer was scheduled to inspect E Company. Sobel gave Lieutenant Winters orders to inspect the latrine at 1000 hours. A few minutes later, at about 0930 hours, Lieutenant Colonel Strayer told Winters to censor the enlisted men's mail. That was a job that could not be done at headquarters, so Winters hopped on his bicycle and rode to his quarters, a small room in a private home in Altborn. Promptly at 1000 hours, he returned, parked his bicycle outside the barracks, and entered to inspect the latrine. To his surprise, Sobel was there making his own inspection. Sobel walked past Winters, head down, giving no indication that he saw the XO. Behind him walked a most unhappy Private Joachim Mello, carrying a mop, soaking wet, dirty, badly needing a shave, hair uncombed. Sobel left without saying a word. Winters inspected the latrine, found that Mello had done a good job. At 10:45 hours, Winters walked into the orderly room to get ready for the company formation. With a hint of a smirk on his face, First Sergeant Evans handed him a typed document. It read, "Company E, 506th PIR, 30 October 43. Subject, punishment under 104th Article of War. To First Lieutenant R.D. Winters. 1. You will indicate by endorsement below whether you desire punishment under 104th AW or trial by courts-martial for failure to inspect the latrine at 0945 this date as instructed by me." Signed with a grand flourish, Herbert M. Sobel, Captain Commanding. Winters confronted Sobel. "Captain," he said after saluting and asking permission to speak, "my orders were to inspect the latrine at 1000 hours. I changed that time to 0945. No one told me. I telephoned and I sent a runner." Winters bit his tongue. There was no telephone in his room, and no runner had come. It was time for inspection. Strayer went down the ranks and through the barracks. Everything, including the latrine, was satisfactory. Winters, meanwhile, made up his mind on how to respond to Sobel. On the bottom of the typed sheet, he wrote by hand, "Subject, punishment under 104th AW or trial by courts-martial. 2. Captain H.M. Sobel. 1. I request trial by courts-martial for failure to inspect the latrine at 0945 this date. Lieutenant R. D. Winters, XO, Company E. Sobel replied the following day. 1. You will be denied a 48-hour pass until after December 15, 1943. 2. In accordance with the procedure outlined in the courts-martial manual, you will inutate, Sergeant Evans evidently had trouble either typing or spelling initiate, your own letter of appeal with your reasons for objection and also a request for trial by courts-martial. Winters simmered for 3 days. So far as he could make out, Sobel was saying, look, don't be silly. Take the punishment and forget the courts-martial. Sobel knew that the punishment was a matter of indifference to Winters, as Winters spent his weekends on the post, reading or playing sports. But Winters had had enough. He wanted to force the moment to a crisis. The competition he had never wanted, between himself and Sobel for leadership of E Company, had to be settled. The company was not big enough for both of them. On November 4th, Winters appealed his punishment under the 104th Article of War. Sobel made an endorsement the next day. 1. Punishment for the above offense given by the undersigned will not be lifted by him. 2. When given another task to perform by a ranking officer to myself, Strayer's order to censor the mail, you should have delegated your task to another officer to inspect the latrine and not let it go until such time that there was little time for corrective measures to be taken before the arrival of the general officer about 10 minutes later. He signed with his usual flourish. Winter's request for a court-martial, meanwhile, was posing a problem that was not as funny as it sounded for the 2nd Battalion staff. The officers got out the court-martial manual and studied it intensively to try to figure out some way to get out from under this embarrassment. They finally did, and Strayer set aside the punishment and declared the case closed. No court-martial. Sobel was not finished. The next day, November 12th, Evans handed Winters another typed order. Subject: failure to instruct latrine orderly. To First Lieutenant R.D. Winters. 1. You will reply by endorsement hereon your reason for failure to instruct Private J. Mello in his duties as latrine orderly. 2. You will further reply why he was permitted to be on duty at 10:30 hours October 30th in need of a shave. I give up, Winters decided. Go ahead and shoot me. In that mood, he replied by endorsement. 1. Reason for failure to instruct Private J. Mello in his duties as latrine orderly, no excuse. 2. Reason why he was permitted to be on duty at 10:30 hours in need of a shave, no excuse. The next day, Strayer decided, for the good of E Company, where naturally the long-anticipated showdown between Sobel and Winters was the talk of the barracks, to transfer Winters out of easy. Strayer made him battalion mess officer. That was an insult to Winters, in his view. You only give a job like that to a guy that can't do anything right. With Winters gone, Sobel still in charge and combat coming, the NCOs were in an uproar. Sergeants Ranney and Harris called a meeting. With the exception of Evans and one or two others, all the NCOs in E Company attended. Ranney and Harris proposed that they present Colonel Sink with an ultimatum. Either Sobel be replaced or they would turn in their stripes. They stressed that they would have to act together, with no dissenters and no identifiable leader. This radical proposal elicited much comment, many questions, great concern. But in the end, the group decision was that going into battle under Sobel's command was unthinkable. The only way they could let Strayer and Sink know how strongly they felt was to turn in their stripes. Each non-com thereupon wrote out his own resignation. Lipton's went as follows. I hereby turn in my stripes. I no longer want to be a non-commissioned officer in Company E. Lipton was CQ that night, charge of quarters, the sergeant who slept in the orderly room to be available to handle any problems that came up during the night. to wake the men in the morning, etc. He gathered up the resignations and put the stack in Sobel's in-basket. The NCOs then thought further about what they were doing and decided to consult with Winters. He was invited to the orderly room, where on arrival Ranny told him what the group had done.
"Don't," said Winters. "Don't even think about it. This is mutiny."
The NCOs protested. As the discussion continued, Sobel walked in. Everyone was speechless. Sobel did not say a word. He just walked over to his desk and picked up a book. As he turned to leave, Ranny said in a normal voice, "Now, Lieutenant Winters, what are we going to do about improving our athletic program?" Sobel gave no hint of concern. He just walked out. Winters felt that Sobel had to have known what was going on. Hell, there was no secret about it. Ranny had invited Evans to the meeting. It was all but certain Evans had told Sobel. Indeed, by this time, the whole battalion was talking about Sobel's battles, first with Winters, now with his NCOs. Sink would have to have been deaf, dumb, and blind not to have been aware. He should also have been grateful that Winters had talked the NCOs out of presenting him with an ultimatum. A few days later, Sink came down to Company E, called all the non-coms together, and, as Lipton recalled, "gave us hell. He told us we had disgraced our company and that he could put every one of us in the guardhouse for years. As we were preparing for combat, he said that it could be called mutiny in the face of the enemy, for which we could be shot." Fortunately for Sink, the 101st Airborne had just established a parachute jumping school at the nearby village of Chilton Foliat. In order to qualify as paratroopers, doctors, chaplains, communications men, forward artillery observers, and others who would be jumping on D-Day. Who better than Sobel to run a training camp? Sink sent Sobel to Chilton Foliat and brought 1st Lieutenant Patrick Sweeney from Able Company to be XO of Easy. He made 1st Lieutenant Thomas Meehan of Baker the CO of Easy, and he brought Winters back as leader of the 1st Platoon. Sergeant Ranny was busted to private, and Harris was transferred. The Sobel era of Easy Company had come to an end. Meehan was Sobel's opposite. Slender, fairly tall, willowy, he had common sense and competence. He was strict but fair. He had good voice command. "Under Meehan," Winters said, "we became a normal company." Training intensified. On December 13th, the company made a night jump and lost its first man, Private Rudolf Dietrich, of 1st Platoon, due to parachute failure. Platoons and squads were being sent out on three-day problems, with different men being put in command, as lieutenants and sergeants were declared out of action. "Imagine me a platoon leader," Carson wrote in his diary on December 12th. "No, it can't be." But it was. They were learning to be resourceful, which included learning to live off the land. This included fishing by tossing hand grenades into the streams and improving their diet by finding deer on the country estates that were willing to walk into a bullet in the head. Christmas was a day off, with all the turkey a man could eat. New Year's Eve was quiet. "We just waited up for the new year," Carson wrote. "I wonder what it shall bring. Wonder how many of us will see 1945. On January 18th, General Bernard Law Montgomery, commander of the 21st Army Group, to which the 101st was attached, came to Chilton Foliat for an inspection. He reviewed the regiment, then told the men to break ranks and rally round his jeep. Climbing onto the bonnet, he told them how good they were. After seeing the 506th, he said, "I pity the Germans." As the days slowly began to lengthen, meaning decent fighting weather was approaching, tension increased. Inevitably, the young men thought of death. Few made their thoughts articulate, but Webster dealt with his directly. He wrote his mother, instructing her to "stop worrying about me. I joined the parachutists to fight. I intend to fight. If necessary, I shall die fighting. But don't worry about this, because no war can be won without young men dying. Those things which are precious are saved only by sacrifice. In February, training became more big unit oriented as the 101st and indeed the entire invasion force of more than 7 divisions began rehearsals for the attack on Normandy. On March 23rd, the 2nd and 3rd battalions of the 506th made a combined jump, by far the largest of the war to date for the regiment. The occasion was an inspection visit by Prime Minister Winston Churchill, Supreme Allied Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower, U.S. First Army Commander Omar Bradley, General Maxwell Taylor, Commander of the 101st, General Lee had a heart attack in February and was forced to return to the States, and numerous other big shots. The jump was a huge success. The C-47s came roaring through the sky in a perfect V of Vs. Churchill and the generals were watching from a specially constructed grandstand. The troopers began leaping out of their planes, stick after stick, more than 1,000 men and parachutes filling the sky in a seemingly unending deluge. The instant they hit the ground, the troopers were twisting out of their chutes and heading for the assembly area on a dead run, putting their weapons together without slackening speed. The visitors were amazed at the rapidity of the movement. As the regimental scrapbook put it, the boys from Currahee had made a grand impression. Later, the regiment assembled in front of the reviewing stand. Taylor invited Churchill and Eisenhower to inspect the ranks. They did, stopping occasionally to ask a question or two of one of the men. Eisenhower stopped in front of Malarkey. "Soldier, where are you from?" Eisenhower talked to thousands of enlisted men on such inspections before D-Day. Invariably, his first question was, "Where are you from?" "Astoria, Oregon," Malarkey answered. "What did you do before the war?" Malarkey said he was a student at the University of Oregon. Ike wanted to know who won last fall's Oregon-Oregon State football game and whether Malarkey intended to return to college after the war. Then he turned to Churchill and suggested that the Prime Minister might have a question. "Well, son, how do you like England?" Malarkey assured him that he liked it very much, and he had always enjoyed English literature and history. Churchill promised to get him back to the States as soon as possible. "It was," said Malarkey, "a very memorable occasion." Even larger maneuvers were held immediately after the Churchill jump, with the purpose of dovetailing the paratroopers, glider-borne units, and ground forces with the air forces and naval elements. Exercises were held throughout southwest England with mass airdrops and amphibious operations. On one maneuver, Guarnieri told Privates Warren Muck and Malarkey to drop a mortar shell on a 6-foot square white target situated on a dune about 600 yards to their front. Malarkey fired once, too long. A second time, too short. At that moment, some staff officers came up, accompanied by General Taylor. One of the staff officers told Guarnieri to have his mortar squad fire at the target as a demonstration for the general. Guarnieri told Malarkey and Muck to fire 3 rounds. In rapid succession, they dropped 3 rounds down the barrel. Boom! The first hit the target dead center. Boom! Boom! The other 2 came down on top of the destroyed target. "Sergeant, is your squad always that accurate?" Taylor asked. "Yes, sir," Guarnieri replied. "My boys never miss." The 101st took trains back to barracks in Wiltshire and Berkshire. General Taylor and his staff were well aware that there were many kinks to work out. The boys from Currahee had learned their lessons about small unit tactics well. Now it was up to the generals to fit them properly into the larger whole. Chapter 4. "Look out, Hitler, here we come." Slapton Sands, A Pottery, April 1st through June 5th, 1944. The 101st Airborne, the 82nd Airborne, and the 4th Infantry Division made up the 7th Corps. The 7th Corps and the 5th Corps, 1st Infantry and 29th Infantry Divisions, made up the U.S. First Army, General Omar Bradley commanding. Eisenhower had given Bradley the task of establishing a beachhead on each side of the mouth of the Douve River, where the French coast makes a right angle. Running to the east is the Calvados coast. Running to the north is the base of the Cotentin Peninsula. The Fifth Corps was to take the Calvados coast, codename for the target area Omaha Beach, while the Seventh Corps was to take the base of the Cotentin, codename Utah Beach. The Seventh Corps at Utah would be on the extreme right flank of the invasion area, which stretched from the mouth of the Orne River on the left, east, some 65 to 70 kilometers to the Cotentin. Eisenhower needed to provide sufficient width to the invasion to bring in enough infantry divisions in the first wave to overpower the enemy dug in behind Hitler's Atlantic Wall. Hitler made only one big mistake when he built his Atlantic Wall, the paratroopers like to say. He forgot to put a roof on it. In one way, Utah was the easiest of the five assault beaches. At the British and Canadian beaches, Sword, Juno, and Gold, east of Omaha, the numerous vacation homes, small shops, and hotels and casinos that lined the coast provided the Germans with excellent protection for machine gun nests, while at Omaha, a bluff rising from the beach to a height of 200 to 300 feet gave the German defenders, dug into a trench system on a World War II scale, the ability to shoot down on troops coming out of the landing craft. But Utah had neither bluff nor houses. There were some fixed defenses made of reinforced concrete containing artillery and machine guns. The biggest was at La Madeleine in the middle of Utah. The fortification took its name from a nearby religious shrine that dated back to Viking days. But the gradual slope and low sand dunes at Utah meant that getting across and beyond the beach was not going to be as difficult as at Omaha. The problem at Utah was what lay inland. Behind the sand dunes was low ground, used by the Norman farmers for grazing cattle. Four narrow, unimproved roads ran inland from the beach. These roads were raised a meter or two above the ground. Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, the German commander, had flooded the fields with the idea of forcing any troops and armor coming inland to use the roads, causeways, Eisenhower's planners called them. Rommel had most of his artillery in camouflaged positions or reinforced casemates and bunkers back from the flooded area, where it could bombard the roads. Rommel had his infantry prepared to take up defensive positions along the western end of the roads, where it could repel any troops moving up them. The task Eisenhower gave the 101st was to seize these causeway exits. The method to be used was a night drop. The aim was to disrupt the Germans, create surprise and havoc, and get control of those exits and destroy the big guns before the Germans could react. It would be an intricate, tricky, and risky operation. To have any chance of success, it would be necessary to practice. For the practice to be realistic, it would be necessary to find a piece of English coastline similar to Utah Beach. Slapton Sands in Devonshire, in southwestern England, was similar to Utah. A long, narrow stretch of beach was separated from dry ground by a shallow lake and adjoining swamp. Two bridges crossed from the shoreline to high ground. And so it was that the Seventh Corps carried out its rehearsal for the part it was to play on D-Day at Slapton Sands. At the end of April, the entire Seventh Corps participated in Exercise Tiger. E Company rode in trucks to a resort hotel on the seashore at Torquay, where it spent a comfortable night. The next day, April 26th, it was back into the trucks for a ride to an area back from Slapton Sands from which all civilians had been evacuated. The company slept in the field until midnight when trucks brought the men forward to a simulated drop zone. After assembly, the company marched overland through a mist to an elevated point a mile back from the beach and set up a defensive position guarding the bridge. At dawn, Webster wrote, "We could see a vast fleet of amphibious craft moving slowly in to land. I've never seen so many ships together at one time. An invasion fleet is the most impressive sight in the world." What he had not seen was the disaster of the previous evening. German torpedo boats had slipped in among the LSTs and other big assault craft carrying the 4th Infantry. The Germans sank 2 LSTs and damaged others. More than 900 men drowned. The incident was covered up by the Allies for fear that it would hurt morale among the troops scheduled to go to France in LSTs. It remained covered up for more than 40 years, evidently out of embarrassment. Webster, watching the men of the 4th Infantry come up from the beach and pass through E Company's positions, noted that they were sweating, cursing, panting. He also recorded that the officers informed the men that "we cannot write about our Torquay excursion." In the afternoon, the company made a 25-mile march and then bivouacked in a woods for the night. In the morning of April 28th, it rode in trucks back to Altborn. That weekend, Malarkey, Chuck Grant, Skip Muck, and Joe Toya got passes to London, with Muck's best friend from Tonawanda, New York, Fritz Neeland of the 501st PIR. There they met Neeland's brother, Bob, who was a squad leader in the 82nd Airborne and who had seen action in North Africa and Sicily. They spent the evening in a pub listening to Bob Neeland talk about combat. He made a remark that Malarkey never forgot. "If you want to be a hero, the Germans will make one out of you real quick. Dead." On the train going back to Altborn, Malarkey told Muck that it sounded to him like Bob Neeland had lost his effectiveness. Back in Altborn in the first week of May, E Company went through more problems, attacking gun positions, bridges, causeways, and other objectives, once attacking after a real jump, other times simulating the air flight and jumping out of trucks. From May 9th to 12th, the 101st held its dress rehearsal for D-Day, codename Operation Eagle. The entire division participated. Easy used the same airfield it would use on D-Day, a pottery. Personnel and equipment were loaded onto the same aircraft the company would use on the real thing. The takeoff, drop, and assembly followed the plan as close to the letter as possible, including spending the same amount of time in flight. Climbing aboard the C-47s was difficult because of all the gear each man carried. Individuals were overloaded, following the age-old tendency of soldiers going into combat to attempt to be ready for every conceivable emergency. The vest and long drawers issued each man were impregnated to ward off a possible chemical attack. It made them cumbersome. They stank. They itched. They kept in body heat and caused torrents of sweat. The combat jacket and trousers were also treated. The men carried a pocket knife in the lapel of their blouses to be used to cut themselves out of their harness if they landed in a tree. In their baggy trousers pockets, they had a spoon, razor, socks, cleaning patches, flashlight, maps, 3-day supply of K rations, an emergency ration package, 4 chocolate bars, a pack of charms, powdered coffee, sugar, and matches, ammunition, a compass, 2 fragmentation grenades, an anti-tank mine, a smoke grenade, a gammon bomb, a 2-pound plastic explosive for use against tanks, and cigarettes, 2 cartons per man. The soldier topped his uniform with a webbing belt and braces, a .45 pistol, standard for non-coms and officers, privates had to get their own, and most did, water canteen, shovel, first aid kit, and bayonet. Over this went his parachute harness, his main parachute in its backpack, and reserve parachute hooked on in front. A gas mask was strapped to his left leg, and a jump knife bayonet to his right. Across his chest, the soldier slung his musette bag with his spare underwear and ammunition, and in some cases TNT sticks, along with his broken-down rifle or machine gun or mortar, diagonally up and down across his front, under his reserve chute pack, leaving both hands free to handle the risers. Over everything, he wore his Mae West life jacket. Finally, he put on his helmet. Some men added a third knife. Others found a place for extra ammunition. Gordon, carrying his machine gun, figured he weighed twice his normal weight. Nearly every man had to be helped into the C-47. Once aboard, the men were so wedged in they could not move. General Taylor had moved heaven and earth to get enough C-47s for Operation Eagle. The planes were in constant demand for logistical support throughout ETO, and Troop Carrier Command came last on the list. It was cheated on equipment. The fuel tanks did not have armor protection from flak. Easy got its briefing for Eagle on May 10th and 11th. The objective was a gun battery covering the beach. At dusk on May 11th, Easy took off. The planes made legs over England, flying for about 2.5 hours. Shortly after midnight, the company jumped. For Easy, the exercise went smoothly. For other companies, there were troubles. 2nd Battalion Headquarters Company was with a group that ran into a German air raid over London. Flak was coming up. The formation broke up. The pilots could not locate the DZ. 8 of the 9 planes carrying Company H of the 502nd dropped their men on the village of Ramsbury, 9 miles from the DZ. 28 planes returned to their airfields with the paratroopers still aboard. Others jumped willy-nilly, leading to many accidents. Nearly 500 men suffered broken bones, sprains, and other injuries. The only consolation the airborne commanders could find in this mess was that by tradition, a bad dress rehearsal leads to a great opening night. On the last day of May, the company marched down to trucks lined up on the Hungerford Road. Half the people of Altbourne and nearly all the unmarried girls were there to wave goodbye. There were many tears. The baggage left behind gave some hope that the boys would be back. Training had come to an end. There had been 22 months of it, more or less continuous.
This is the end of Disc 2.